The first reading this morning consists of major excerpts from a longer poem by A.E. Spellman, who was the longtime poet in residence at Great Morehouse College in Atlanta. It's called Theology. It's not the easiest poem in the world, so I'll keep on reading it till you get it. Sometimes the day deceives me, and I think the ashes have settled enough that I might see. I try to digest all I observe when I search frantically for God, whose most credible sightings are within. But silence cannot call God to be. The colors of the earth cannot call God to be. The question why cannot call God to be. The oppressive distance of the stars, the making, living, or losing of life cannot call God to be. God must be the being that calls itself to be in the unspoken quiet. Oh, I do hear those who claim title to God's inaudible song. Their arias, their songs, are brilliant. Their voices swoop. They sing, they seek to carol through the grave, to merge with some eternal chord. Do not allow me to belittle the faith of the godded people with God. Do not allow me to belittle their faith. They do doubt. They doubt the wisdom of their own flesh, the wisdom of the earth, the wisdom of their reason. They doubt me. Me, I see oppression. My faith is finite. It doesn't turn corners, skim time, or till the cosmic soil. My faith is local, and it sustains me by the hour. I would, if I could, name what lives in me, a soul. But to name a soul is not to be eternal, and to name that soul God is not to be God. I crave it all, but live on enough. Atheist, I worship the play of the leaf and the wind. I worship the stand of the strong against the wrong. It would satisfy me. It really would satisfy me if my labor left some small advance, not even my name, to mark my living. Let the next ones, let the ones who come after me, notice that the growth touched by me has shifted toward the sun. If they must call it God's work, I will say, no, it was mine. It was my work. And then they will say, "Even so, and I will answer, even so." The second reading is from the late great American poet with both Jewish and Christian family heritage, Denise Levertov. This beautiful poem is her reflection on the process of how to approach thinking about ideas like God, and it's called Contraband.
The tree of knowledge was the tree of reason. That's why the taste of it drove us from Eden. That fruit was meant to be dried and milled to a fine powder for use a pinch at a time, a condiment. God probably planned to tell us about this new pleasure. We stuffed our mouths full of it, gorged on but and how and again, but knowing no better. It's toxic in large quantities. Fumes swirled in our heads and around us to form a dense cloud that hardened to steel, a wall between us and God, who was paradise. Not that God is unreasonable, but reason in such excess was tyranny and locked us into its own limits, a polished cell reflecting our own faces. God lives on the other side of the mirror, but through the slit where the barrier doesn't quite touch the ground, manages still to squeeze in as filtered light, a strain of music heard, then lost, then heard again.
So my good friend Bonnie finally emailed me after I had been calling her for days. She and her husband live in Puerto Montt, Chile, 515 kilometers south of earthquake-ravished Concepcion. Their daughter, Andrea Maria, my goddaughter, lives up in Santiago, where the airport was closed for days because of the quake. I used the overseas operator 7 times in 2 days and couldn't get through to any place in Chile, let alone their farm. Finally, after 3 days, I got a dial tone, but to no avail. No one was at home, and the answering machine wasn't on. Of course, by then I was starting to imagine the worst. You know how fears can pile up like that. But Bonnie, bless her heart, finally emailed me to tell me that all three of them had been on vacation in the deep south when the earthquake happened, in Patagonia, in the Torres del Paine Mountains. As it is, they are still down in Patagonia. They're stuck there. Chilean airplanes have not been flying. But they did find out through local cell phones that their farm and their house and their friends' houses and their apartment up in Santiago, everything's okay. Wrote Bonnie in her email, "Thank God," or whatever. "Nothing was damaged," she wrote. God or whatever. Interesting phrase, that. Now, let me be clear. Bonnie's letter to me was not an essay in her personal theology, okay? She was not defining God as the author of earthquakes. She was simply saying she was relieved. She was saying she was glad, happy that the places where her family members lay their head at night were not damaged. She was not, it seems to me, thinking of herself as somehow deserving to be saved, someone especially blessed. No, thank God or whatever is a statement of emotion, not theology. But it did strike me that she knows there is a language problem with the word God, because she does add the whatever. Maybe that's her substitute for the word luck or fate. But those are words as problematic for many as the word God is, right? Still, her phrasing reminds me that at the very least, the word God poses a problem for many. And it seems like it has since ancient times. The passage from the Hebrew Scriptures at the top of your orders of celebration from the book of Malachim or Kings was written 2,400 years ago, we think, from internal evidence. Yet that particular author, whoever it was, is quite clear that whatever else the ineffable or God may be about, earthquakes, hurricanes, and forest fires are not evidences of God in any way. They, the biblical editors suggest, are just what they are. If you are looking for God, says the author, pay attention to the lean, thin silence inside of you. The lean, thin silence. The famous King James Version renders that Hebrew as still, small voice. The still, small voice inside you. Still other translators render the Hebrew phrase kol demamadak as a soft murmuring sound, or the sound of a whisper. Take your pick. You get the picture, whatever translation you favor. Because the author of that poetic passage seems to think that whatever else God may mean as a word, bombast and lightning bolts are simply not part of the picture. You have to search in subtleties, the passage is saying, silence and hunches and whispers. What Unitarian minister from the 19th century, Waldo Emerson, used to call intuition or spontaneity or even instinct. Or I like how poet Denise Levertov describes this subtlety. God, she says, manages to squeeze in as filtered light, a strain of music heard and then lost and then heard again. But there is no God, you say. Auschwitz proves that once and for all. Or how can anyone know if there is a God, you ask? How can you imagine any being that could explain both a pink and purple sunset over the Pacific in Hawaii and a child dying of a 1 in a million genetic disorder? You can't. That's why. So why bother? A strain of music heard and then lost? What does she mean? She's not saying God is a song by Sinatra that I've half forgotten, is she? What sense does that make? None. But that's the point. Levertov is not against reason. She's entirely for it. But there can be too much reasoning. Like food. Food, in all of its varieties, is good, especially if someone cooks it well. But you don't have to be the Surgeon General of the United States to realize that too much of it will rob you of your health. Same thing with reason. I can reason that the word God makes no sense because all the famous philosophical proofs of God fail to convince me. I can reason that the overwhelming narcissism of many of television's preachers is just so blatant that the word God is too tainted to use without me wincing. I can reason that because God is depicted in stories as being downright brutal in many biblical and Quranic passages, that it's just better to have no truck with that word at all. I can reason that Buddhism and Confucianism and some other religions do very well without such a word. So what's wrong with me doing that as well? Those are all really fine reasons. I like them all. But those reasons will clog my brain and my heart both if I assume that such reasons ought or should be universal. For example, Gustavo Gutierrez says that to know God is to do justice. To know God is to do justice. But even to say that, to know God is to do justice. Now, I can get upset when I hear that and I can say, why not just say, to do justice is to do justice and leave it at that? But even to say that means I must think that Gustavo Gutierrez is a lot like me, an American citizen living in a Midwestern city with moderate but very real affluence. But he isn't. He's a Peruvian, a Native American with Quechua ancestry, and he has lived much of his life among people who might be described accurately as remarkably poor, and poor because of insane systems of injustice. Will anyone tell me now that the word God is useful only as a crutch for the poor, but is easily dismissed by anyone who's affluent? If so, then I have many more sermons to preach, I think, about systems theory, about economic theory, and about shame and power and privilege. At the BREAD Interfaith Clergy, for those of you who are new, BREAD is our interfaith social justice organization. At the BREAD Interfaith Clergy meeting on Thursday, Susan Smith of Advent United Church of Christ preached a truly thrilling sermon on God as the source of the call to justice, quoting a passage from the book of the prophet Haggai in the Hebrew Scriptures, which contains the following observations put in the mouth of God, so to speak. Consider how you're faring. You have sowed much and harvested little. You eat without being ever satisfied. You drink but are never full. You clothe yourselves, but you're never comfortable. And if you earn a salary, it burns a hole in your pocket. These are stinging words of social criticism found in a justice-rooted text many, many hundreds of years old. After the sermon, Tim Ahrens, who ministers down at First Congregational Church downtown, told us how these words affected him. He got up and he said, "I never understand what people mean when they tell me that they believe in God. I just don't understand what they're talking about." As if to say it's important to decide whether or not God actually is something somewhere. Rather, he said, "I'd rather turn to the words ascribed to God, interpret them with my own heart and mind, and listen to their call to love and to justice, and then to put them into practice." This theology is similar, it seems to me, to the words of the lesbian Episcopal priest, Carter Hayward, who at the top of your orders of service writes, putting the word God in small letters, that God is our common strength, whose movement is to empower, whose name in history is love. Recently, I heard a story about an event in a Unitarian Universalist congregation. Who knows what congregation it was? I don't remember. Maybe it was nearby, or maybe it was far away, but no matter, this is a true story. A husband and wife were at a dinner party together with other members of the congregation. I really don't know what the husband's theology was. No one told me that. But the wife was definitely someone for whom God was an important word. She was not a fundamentalist or a rigid person any more than Gutierrez is a rigid person or Carter Hayward is a rigid person or Martin Luther King was a rigid person or the poets Rumi or Kabir were rigid people or Denise Levertov was a rigid person. No, the wife was not a fundamentalist, nor did she have some crazy religious agenda to foist on everybody. But she did find comfort and support and challenge in what Hayward calls the movement of God to empower us together. Now, another member of the same congregation, also at that dinner, when she heard the wife bring God into the conversation over and over, responded, "I just don't know how you or anyone can believe in such a thing as God. With all the suffering in the world, with all the wars and fighting, it simply makes no sense. There's no reason in it." I wish this woman had just simply asked the wife what God meant to her, or how she imagined God. But she didn't. She proclaimed, "There's simply no sense in believing what you believe." Well, you see, it did make sense to the wife. Mind you, she was no fool. She knew about suffering, Auschwitz, Pol Pot, all the genocides, the death of innocents daily. She knew about racism and other injustices. But it's fair to say she was actually suffering herself right there at the dinner. Why? Because the phrase, "How can you believe?" is not English. It's a knife. It's ridicule, however unintentioned. It's a proclamation of personal superiority in theological matters. It's a sundering of any possibility of any real relationship or even a conversation. What happened at the end of the story is predictable. The wife never came back to any church suppers with her husband or to the church at all from that day on. Why would she? This is a sad story for me. Oh, I understand the passion behind questions about God. Do you think I don't have it? I understand the electricity of freedom crackling in those who have turned away from what they were taught, namely that God is a superhuman being who is rigid, controlling, the source of sickness, earthquakes, and storms, and who flings people into hell forever. I am all for rejecting such gods. But still, I'm troubled. What troubles me is that it was impossible for this person to imagine that someone else, someone with whom she could have had a great relationship, might also feel the electricity of freedom flowing in her. The electricity of an image of God that she feels spurs her to do justice work, spurs her to deeper compassion, spurs her to fierce, honest self-questioning. What troubles me is that it was impossible for this person to understand that this woman might be strengthened by the image of God in Denise Levertov's poem, which affirms that God is paradise itself. Maybe this image helps her to desire that the world too become a paradise, full of abundance for all, no matter who. Oh, my critic might chime in, all that poetry stuff. It's just your imagination. To which I hope the woman in question, the wife at the table, might have had the strength to say, "Of course it's my imagination. Do you think that what I imagine isn't part of reality? Is there really something wrong, evil, or stupid about seeing the world as a sacred garden?" What troubles me is that someone who lives with fears, like the girl in our story this morning, might want a way to address fears which paralyze her. In the story this morning, the girl names the gibberwillies, the fears, one by one, and the wise mother puts them in the pail and tosses them out the window. Maybe for some, God is like an image in their heart as sturdy as that pail, an idea they find powerful and effective to set them free, not just from fears named gibberwillies, but from addiction and from self-loathing. Okay, maybe for you those images don't work. That's fine. Maybe you face your fears by just whistling in the dark, or like me, by working with a therapist over long years to confront my own gibberwillies. But my point is, what business is it of any of us to suggest that it's better for others not to use certain words or ideas or concepts that work well for them and which heal them, even if it's true they don't work for others? What business is it of anyone's? I like what A.B. Spellman says in his most remarkable poem, "Do not allow me to belittle the faith of the godded," he prays. And he prays that even though he is an atheist who doesn't worship God, but rather the play of the leaf and the wind, the stand of the strong against the wrong. But my colleagues in BREAD also most certainly worship the stand of the strong against the wrong. Heck, that's what the organization's about. And they believe in God. And of course, Cantor Chomsky and Reverend Frosch and Imam Haney, who also believe in God, also adore the play of the wind and the leaf. I know I do. It's hard to imagine anyone who hasn't gotten a little lift around here this week as the sun starts drawing all those leaves up through the snow. So some speak just of leaves, and others speak of leaves and God in the same sentence. Is one person really better or wiser than the other? So one person speaks of justice, and the other speaks of justice and God in the same sentence. Is one person really more representative of the human race than the other? Oh, do not allow me to belittle the faith of the godded, writes Spellman. Right. But note, just because he doesn't belittle does not mean he has to give up observation and even critique. He notes, for example, They do doubt the wisdom of their flesh. I wish they wouldn't do that. They do doubt the wisdom of the earth and their reason. I wish they wouldn't do that. They doubt me, he says. But he also is not afraid to look at himself and describe himself. My faith is finite, he says, does not turn corners, skim time. My faith is local and sustains me just by the hour. But what I like most about Spellman's amazing lines is the ending. You figured that out, I suppose. He seems to realize that there will never, ever be a time in the history of the human race, never, 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 when everyone agrees in some common image of God that everyone can share, which is the stated hope of most religious conservatives that I know, believing it will be their own God. And just as true, he also realizes that there will never, never, never be a time when everyone just gives up religion and spiritual language, the stated prediction of many non-religious progressives of the last century, and this one. This is how Spellman does it. He writes, "Let the next ones," that is, the next generations, "notice that any growth that I've caused to shift toward the sun, like these new spring shoots, is mine. If they call it God's work, I will say, no, it was mine." And then with humility that almost blinds with its brightness, he concludes, "And they will say, even so. And I will answer, even so." And so it goes on. The earthquakes and the fires, the poetry and the prose, the stories and the questions, reason and feelings, intuition and science, newer images of God coming to life, older images of God being dashed to the ground, people like Thoreau turning away from God, and thus he claims discovering some intimation, some filtered light, illuminating ultimacy. Who knows? All I know is that God and Bonnie's whatever need to share the same world, the same beds, the same communities, and the same historic age. And that at least part of what it means to be a Unitarian Universalist is to always find a way to help people feel as safe and supported as possible while they deepen images or while they smash them, run to them or run away from them, or try to live without images at all. Although I think that must be very hard. Still, I can't imagine a more beautiful way of living out our days together.